Okay, I think I left off with, where did Israel get its name? It gets its name from Jacob. Jacob is the third patriarch after Abraham and Isaac. And Jacob has his name turned to Israel after he defeats God in a wrestling match. And Israel literally means he who wrestles with God. Jacob/Israel is the father of 12 sons who become the progenitors of the 12 tribes of Israel. And so Israel gets its name from Israel, the third patriarch, otherwise known as Jacob. Do we get a clear, unequivocal statement of monotheism throughout the Torah, or is there some ambiguity? And there is some ambiguity. Early on, it's not clear that God is the only God. As a matter of fact, you get tacit acknowledgement of the existence of other gods. You get that verse in the book of Exodus that says, "Who is like you, O Yahweh, among the gods?" And what you have really is monolatry, which is the worship of one God, otherwise known as henotheism, which is the idea of you have sort of a great God, and then you have these other much, much, much lesser gods. And the commandment against worshiping other gods doesn't say the other gods don't exist. It says that Yahweh is a jealous God, and the reason he doesn't want you worshiping other gods is because he wants you all to himself. Not that these other gods don't exist or are a waste of your time or are false gods. So it's assumed that these other gods exist. It's just that Yahweh is head and shoulders above them. He is the greatest God. And so the concept of God evolves in the Tanakh so that later, by the time you get to the prophets, you get a situation where in the book of Isaiah, for example, God says, "Is there a God besides me? I don't know of any." And you get an account of a conflict between the priests of Yahweh, led by Elijah, and the priests of Baal. And they have this contest where they each urge their God to come down and consume their sacrifice. And the priests of Baal, they cry out to their God, they cut themselves, they wail, and they put on a big show, and nothing happens. Elijah just simply goes up to his sacrifice, and he pours water all over it just to make a point of it, and then gives a simple invocation of Yahweh to come down and consume the sacrifice, and fire rains down from comes down from heaven and consumes the sacrifice. And the implication there is that, you know, Baal isn't really a real God. He doesn't even exist. It's just sort of a false belief on the part of the priests of Baal. And that Yahweh really does exist and really does have power. You also get in the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah makes fun of the idolaters, and he says, "Look, the idolater, he takes the same piece of wood, he takes half of it and chops it into kindling for his food, and the other half he carves into the image of something, and he bows down before it and says, 'You are my God.' And how stupid is that? Because it's the same block of wood, right?" And so he's thinking that there is no reality beyond this block of wood. You just have some idiot who's worshiping a block of wood, and that's all there is to these pagan gods. Very different from, again, the early parts of Genesis, where it's assumed that other gods exist. Also, you get this change of Yahweh from this sort of finite Hebrew deity who doesn't know things, who has or can take on a human form, who wrestles with Jacob, who appears to Abraham at the Oaks of Mamre and sits down and has supper with him, Yahweh and two angels, who haggles with Abraham over the fate of the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, who walks in the cool of the morning in the Garden of Eden, and seems to have a human form when you're told that you can't see his face and live, but Moses is told to hide in the cleft of a rock, and that he can sort of glance at God as he's walking away. You can look at my, I can't look at my face, but you can look at my back as I'm passing through. This is when he's giving Moses the replacement set for the original Ten Commandments, which Moses dashed to pieces on the rocks. The concept of corporate responsibility is, leaving aside the Occupy Wall Street jokes, corporate responsibility. Corporate means group responsibility. And this is the idea that God deals with people in groups, and that groups are responsible for things. So you can be held responsible for what your ancestors did, as were the descendants of Canaan, as were the descendants of Amalek, the Amalekites. And God, it rewards and punishes people based on their group membership, not as individuals. And so you could be under a generational curse. You could be wiped out because your ethnic group had committed a sin in past generations. The group suffers as a result of the sins of individuals. So Achan hides loot under his tent, and God doesn't say, "Behold, Achan has sinned," and send a lightning bolt down and strike Achan dead. But he says, "Behold, Israel has sinned," because Achan is an Israelite. And so God punishes Israel by having them lose in battle. After Achan is taken care of and killed along with his family, and the evildoer is rooted out, then all of a sudden God is on the side of the Israelites, and they start winning in battle. So if you were an unfortunate participant in one of these battles that were going on when Yahweh was angry at Israel for Achan's sin, you might have been killed in a battle because of what Achan did. Now, it wasn't your fault. You didn't hide any loot under your tent. But you're paying for Achan's sin because God's wrath comes on the group, not on particular individuals. And this is, you know, the way people think about the wrath of God and acts of God. They're the broad brush. They're not the surgical strike. And so acts of God affect, you know, whole communities. Things like famine and plague and earthquake are things that don't affect just individuals. They affect groups. And also, you know, political things are also seen as the result of God's will. And so, you know, invasions, right, the invasions of the Israelites and their subjugation under foreign powers is seen as a consequence of idolatry. Now, does that mean that every single person in Israel was an idolater? No, it just means that, in general, the community had committed acts of idolatry. Also, the acts of the king can bring God's wrath on the whole community. So David's sin with Bathsheba has political consequences for all of Israel. It results in a rebellion of his son, which affects a lot of people who had nothing to do with it. Solomon's idolatry and his building pagan temples also results in the split of the kingdom of Israel into two parts. And so these acts of kings have effects on their subjects who, you know, didn't participate in these decisions that the kings made. Another example. So those are other examples of corporate or group responsibility. The Exodus means the departure. It's the departure from Egypt. It's about the Israelites being freed from being slaves in Egypt. The Ten Commandments are these really important basic commandments given in the Torah. There are lots of other commandments, but these are the ones that God engraved on two tablets of stone that are the most important ones. And you should know the Ten Commandments for the exam. You don't have to remember them by number, but you should know, like, for example, maybe be able to recognize which of the following is not one of the Ten Commandments. And so so look those over in your notes. And a couple of things to note that are in this paragraph here. The name you're not supposed to use in a frivolous manner or misuse or take in vain. And the third commandment is Yahweh. The sixth commandment, rendered thou shalt not kill in the King James Bible, is not does not refer to capital punishment, does not refer to killing in war, but it refers to premeditated murder. And you can tell that by the context of the book, because in the very next chapter, you get instructions to give the death penalty to certain people. And you have the death penalty was used prodigiously in the Old Testament. And so the idea that this would be a commandment not to ever kill anyone under any circumstances makes no sense. Particularly since even in the book of Exodus you get people commanded to kill their enemies in war. So this is not a good argument for the death penalty, and people who use this verse take it out of its context and misinterpret it. The Sabbath day is Saturday, not Sunday, Saturday. It starts from sundown Friday, actually, and goes to sundown Saturday, since the Jews reckon the beginning of a day starting in the previous evening. So when the sun goes down on our Friday, that's the beginning of Saturday in the Jewish way of reckoning days. But just remember, Saturday is a Sabbath. The Saturday is the seventh day. Sunday is the first day. And if you look in your calendar, right, we still have the calendar where you look on the extreme left unless you've changed your preferences in Yahoo. I think I might have done that in Moodle as well. But an ordinary calendar, you look in the far left, what's the day you see there? You see Sunday. If you look in the far right, what do you see? What's the last day in the row of weeks? Saturday, the seventh day, the Sabbath. That's the day on which God rested, and so you are also supposed to follow the divine order of working for 6 days and resting on the seventh day, the Sabbath. And so the thing you're not supposed to do on the Sabbath is work. There's nothing about a religious meeting or about doing spiritual things or thinking about God or doing certain rituals. No, on the Sabbath, you're just supposed to rest. So the thing you're not supposed to do is work. Let's see, what is the nature of the law delivered to Moses, by Moses to the Israelites? What aspects of human life is it intended to regulate? It's intended to regulate all aspects of human life. So it is a moral law code, a civil law code, and a criminal law code. It regulates every aspect of human life. So it's meant to be both political, religious, and personal. Israel had to wander for 40 years in the desert, in the so-called wilderness, I think in the King James, but it's really the Sinai Desert. Why did they have to do that before coming into the Promised Land? It's because of the faithless generation, which did not believe that God would give them victory over the Canaanites. So they thought that they did a recon mission, and the spies come back with a report, and you had sort of the majority report and the minority report, and most of the spies say there's no way we could invade Canaan and win. People are too powerful. There's giants in the land. We were as grasshoppers in their sight. So they didn't, whereas, you know, just a couple of people, you know, Joshua and Caleb say, well, if God's on our side, then how can we lose? And because of this, God allows Joshua and Caleb into the Promised Land, and everyone else has to die off in the desert, so they're not allowed to come in. So after the faithless generation dies out, then they're allowed to inherit the Promised Land. And, well, not really inherit it. They have to go in and conquer it. But the people who didn't believe God could give them victory over the Canaanites all are forced to die out of old age. So why is Moses barred with the Promised Land? Well, Moses, a long-lived person, you know, could have gotten in the Promised Land, but he angered God by not following orders. He was supposed to speak to a rock and have water come out of it, and he took his stake because he was angry at the people, and he whacked the rock with his staff against God's orders. And so, again, there's a strong focus on obedience. Obedience to the letter of God's law and not deviating from it. What sort of religion did the indigenous people of Canaan practice? Fertility religion, the power of sacred sex. They worship the earth mother and the storm god, usually called Ashtaroth and Baal. Sometimes the worship would take the form of a farmer standing in for Baal in an act of sacred sex with a priestess or temple prostitute who would stand in for Ashtaroth. And the idea was that they would recreate the cycle of cosmic sex between the Earth Mother and the storm god, which gave birth to crops. And so they thought about this cycle of agriculture as being like the human reproductive cycle. And rain was seen as sort of the semen of Baal going down into the earth, and then the crops coming up from the earth was seen as Ashtaroth giving birth. So you could see how this might be attractive to the Israelites, who would say something like, well, God brought me out of Egypt, and my ancestors were slaves, and now I'm free, but what has he done for me lately? I want these crops to grow, and Yahweh's, the God of my ancestors, but doesn't really specialize in farming and agriculture. And I know this fertility stuff, this is what everybody else around me does, so it seems like it might be a good idea maybe I'll worship Yahweh and do my Israelite thing, but then I'll sort of worship Ashtaroth and Baal on the side just to make sure everything's okay. When the Israelites invade, they're ordered to destroy all the religious buildings, sacred objects, temples, sacred pillars. All those are to be destroyed. And the cities put under the ban or devoted to destruction are these particular cities where every living thing in the cities had to be killed, and the cities had to be burned to the ground, and all the wealth, the gold, silver, jewelry that went to the priesthood. Corporate or group responsibility figures in the story of Achan's sin. I just talked about that. Achan's sin results in the Israelites losing in battle, and so his sin affects the whole community. The office of judge in Israel is a military, spiritual, and political leader rolled all into one. A judge would arise when a foreign invader or oppressor was in Israel and had conquered the land because they had worshipped idols. So to what does the author of Judges attribute Israel being conquered and reconquered by foreign invaders? God is punishing them for worshipping idols. What is the secular historical reason for the foreign invasions? Well, it's because the Israelites were a loose confederation of tribes with no central leadership. So when they were conquered, the judge would emerge. He would unite the tribes and serve as a kind of a general and lead the resistance. And united, the tribes were able to drive out the foreign invaders. The judge would rule for a while after his victory, and then he would die. And there was no plan for succession, so they went back to being this loose confederation of tribes, and then the next made them easy pickings for the next invader. Because the one advantage of having a strong central government and having a king is be able to conduct warfare. Warfare is very difficult to conduct through committee. You need a command and control center and structure, and a king in an aristocracy offers that, whereas a loose confederation of tribes that always didn't see things the same way and had different interests wasn't so good for doing that. Samson's riddle shows Samson's disobedience because Samson took a Nazirite vow and he's not supposed to touch dead things. And he's also, let's see, was there something about the lion? I guess it's just that he's not supposed to touch dead things. And he's actually eating some honey that was in a beehive that was in a dead lion's carcass. So that's, he didn't just touch the lion, he's eating something out of a dead thing. So that's that wasn't good. So what was the riddle? The riddle was, out of the eater came something to eat, out of the strong came something sweet. And what is it? And the answer is a beehive in a lion's carcass. What weakness did Samson and Solomon share? Foreign women. Was it God's will for Israel to have a king? No. The people cry out for a king, and God says, well, I'm supposed to be your king. And the people say, we want a king. We want a king like the nations around us. Give us a king. And finally, God relents and says, you want a king? Fine, here's your king. And so this is God's concession to the will of the people, even though he doesn't really want to give them a king. And again, the secular reason is people got tired of being invaded, and they said, we need a king to sort of unite us and to put on a united front against all these people around us that hate us and want to conquer us. And we need someone to rule over the military and to make us, and maybe even to have some invasions into these enemy lands so we can have a buffer zone. And maybe we could conquer some other lands. And so that's what Saul and David did, was they fought against the Philistines and the Canaanites and the Amalekites and all these other groups around them. And their primary role was as of a military leader. So the first king of Israel was Saul, a good military commander, tall, charismatic. But his fatal flaw was that he had a penchant for disobedience. He couldn't follow orders. And as Samuel says to him, disobedience is as a sin of witchcraft. It's like necromancy. And again, there's a strong focus in Judaism on following God's commandments to the letter. And so the two things that Saul does to lose his kingship, he performs a sacrifice, which only the priests are allowed to perform, and then he... in a second episode, he screws up the Amalekite genocide. He botches or flubs it, and he leaves the king alive when he's supposed to kill him, and brings him back as sort of a captive, and cuts off his thumbs, and is going to probably torture him at a big party. And he gives some of the choice cattle and livestock away to his men as spoil. And he's specifically forbidden to do this. So when he gets the order from, and I believe it's Samuel the prophet who gives him the order, it says kill everything. And so when Samuel sees that he's got this spoil he's given to his men, Saul comes up with a story. He says, well, I was just saving these to sacrifice. To Yahweh. Yeah, that's the ticket. I was going to sacrifice these to Yahweh. When the earlier account says that he killed all the sickly and weak animals and then saved all the choice animals that looked like they were healthy and good, and again gave them to his men. David's the next king. Saul dies through a suicide to avoid being captured by the Philistines. After resorting to necromancy in a last-ditch attempt to try to get some advice out of Samuel, who had since died, and finally falls on a sword and commits suicide to avoid being taken alive and tortured by the Philistines. David takes over, takes care of the Philistines, and is a good king and becomes the model for the concept of the Messiah. Why does David's first son with Bathsheba die? Well, David commits a sin by having adultery with Bathsheba, and so punishment is, again, this group responsibility. What did that little baby do to deserve to die? Well, David is this baby's father, and God's going to punish David by killing his baby. And so so God does this as his judgment. But God is portrayed as being merciful because he leaves David alive and forgives him. But he also receives another punishment, which is that his son Absalom organizes a political rebellion against him. And again, as I said in class, God says, your son, Absalom, he didn't actually say your son, but he says, you committed adultery in private, somebody's going to commit adultery against you in public. And this turns out to be fulfilled in Absalom starting a civil war and... or a rebellion. I'm not sure it's not quite a civil war, because Absalom doesn't really have a large number of people on his side, but he's got enough where he's able to take some of David's strongholds and go in and have sex with his harem and all of his wives, thus committing adultery against him in a way that everyone knows and which humiliates David. And again, you know, what did David's wives do to deserve being basically raped by David's son? Well, nothing, but this is seen as God's punishment of David through having his son rape all of his wives. How did the Babylon captivity change the theocratic religion of Israel, of priestly ritual and sacrifice tied to specific geography, to a religion centered around the widespread small independent communities, to a religion centered around widespread small independent communities who got together to pray and study the scriptures? Well, when the Babylonian captivity is a case in which you had Israel is conquered by the Babylonians, or actually Israel, the kingdom of Judah. So Israel splits into two kingdoms, the northern and southern kingdom, as a result of Solomon's idolatry, according to the scriptures, and also according to the scriptures, Rehoboam's rash threats against the northern tribes. So it splits into two kingdoms, and then the northern kingdom falls, and then you have the kingdom of Judah is the only one left. So basically one tribe, the tribe of Judah, and hangers-on in the capital, which includes the capital, Jerusalem, which becomes the kingdom of Judah in the south. And when they're conquered by the Babylonians, the Babylonians take a lot of the people, particularly the prominent important people, and they take them and put them up in Babylon, and then they take some of their people and move them down to Judah. And so when the Israelites Jews, when they're captive in Babylon, they're not living in God's sacred land. They don't have a temple to sacrifice at because it's been destroyed. So the priests can't do the rituals. And there's no king anymore. He's been deposed or killed. So what are they going to do? What do they have left? Well, they have their scriptures, and they can pray, and they can talk about the sacred stories, and they can have like a rabbi to teach them the sacred stories. And so all those particular parts of Judaism today, this focus on devotional prayer and education and meeting at a local house of worship, originally just like a house, as all specifically came out of the Babylonian captivity. So when the Jews were allowed to go back to Judah and rebuild the temple, the whole temple thing, and along with the monarchy, and you know they had kings again, and so all that all that still existed. It was resurrected, but alongside it was the synagogue system. So at the time of Jesus, you had the Sadducees who ran the temple and did all the rituals and sacrifices, and then you had the Pharisees that ran the synagogue system. And so you had both the kind of parallel system. And then once the temple is finally destroyed by the Romans, all you had was the synagogues. What was the Jewish concept of the Messiah? And that's the Messiah is a person who will be descended from David, from that prophecy in 1 Samuel 7, a descendant of David who will restore the kingdom of Israel. He's seen as a military hero and conqueror and king, a political leader, and the concept of the Messiah comes up as follows. So David is promised an everlasting dynasty. He's told that his son will build a temple for God, and that his king, his descendants will have no end. There'll be an everlasting dynasty, a succession of kings descended from David. The only problem is that after one generation, the kingdom is lost. The kingdom splits into two parts. Well, what does that mean? Does God give false prophecies? Of course not. So the people came to see that prophecy is not referring to Solomon, David's son, this, you know, David's seed, as it says in the verse, but some other descendant of David, many generations down, who will then establish an everlasting dynasty sometime in the future. And so by the time Jesus comes around, the Jews are still looking for this person who will restore the kingdom of Israel. And they're looking back to that golden age of Israel where David was king, who's seen as the sort of role model for what a king should be, ruling in God's name. Jewish beliefs about the afterlife in the Torah and almost all the Tanakh, when you're dead, you're dead. And we talked about that today. Do those differ by those held by most Jews at the time of Jesus and today? Most definitely. Later on, you get the concept of resurrection and also of heaven and hell, and you can't fully find those in the Torah and in most of the Tanakh. There's one verse in the whole Old Testament, again, that's in the book of Daniel, probably a pretty late work, like maybe 2nd century BC, which talks about resurrection. So one verse in the whole Bible talks unequivocally about resurrection. And there's I mentioned that hand on life after death, which you'd look at, a couple other passages which people point to, but which, if you look at them carefully, don't really teach a robust concept of resurrection or are questionable for some other reason. And again, go back to the book of Genesis, right? Adam's told, you are dust, and to dust you will return. Adam was taken, you were taken from the earth, and to the earth, you know, to the earth you will return. And there's no concept of immortal soul or of any kind of a experience, good or bad, after you die in early Judaism. Later Judaism, the idea is that someday God will resurrect you from the dead. And there'll be a last judgment, and God will either send you to a place of reward or punishment. And we covered most of these things today. Hanukkah celebrates Jewish independence from the Greek rulers, sometimes called the Greek Syrian rulers. The Seleucids is the name of the dynasty, but you just remember the Greeks. That's a duplication of the concept of Messiah, which we had earlier. Fix that later. How did the destruction of the Jewish temple in 70 AD change Judaism? Well, after the temple is destroyed in 70 AD, there's no more animal sacrifices, and the ritualistic element of Judaism becomes much less important. And so the only thing left, as I said before, is the synagogue system. So that becomes what Judaism is and what it is today. So that's why there are no more animal sacrifices in Judaism. The modern state of Israel was established in 1948, and I think that's the only date I'll ask you to know on this exam. The only particular date, 1948, when Israel was reestablished as a nation. The Talmud is commentary on the Torah by various rabbis, and you have like one rabbi will write an opinion, and then another rabbi will comment on what that first rabbi said, and a third rabbi will comment on what the other two rabbis said, and they sort of write in the margins, and it's kind of like a Facebook post or something, right? Everybody wants to put their opinion in. And then usually, like, the last person to comment sort of sums up what everybody else said and is, sort of gets the last word. So it's commentary, and you get on the Torah, you get some theology, you get demonology, you get And particular advice on how to follow the Sabbath. So all it says in, you know, in the Old Testament, it says, or in the Torah, the commandment, it says, remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. 6 days you shall work, and the seventh day you should rest. Okay, but then you might have the question, like, what counts as work? And you get the section on the Sabbath tells you everything you want to know about what counts as work. And so there's all sorts of particular regulations about what you can carry with you on the Sabbath. And there's even this question about, well, what if I'm a tailor? And I shouldn't carry around the tools of my trade, but what if, like, a needle accidentally sticks in, like, the hem of my shirt and I find it sticking in there as I'm walking down the street? Have I committed a sin? So stuff like that. It gets down to nitty-gritty details. And you get some kind of weird stuff in there that talks about Esau being sort of hairy, and that there's speculation that he was, like, demonic, because demons are called the hairy ones. I guess they're sort of thought of being sort of hairy monsters or something. So we didn't have a chance to go over the Talmud in class, but just remember there's, like, very particular directions about how to, in a practical way, how to follow the very bare-bones Jewish law and how to apply it to particular situations. There's theology, there's demonology, and it's a guidance from important rabbis on how to follow the Jewish law. Now, the four branches of Judaism, just look at that handout and I'll have, like, one question. So that's in middle there, it'll just say four, the four Jewish sects or four branches of Judaism or something like that. Good luck on the exam. See the syllabus for details on testing. If you have any questions, feel free to send me a Moodle message.